So this is November 5th, 2010. My name is Ann Greenleaf. I'm the interviewer. The title of this interview is Bruce Kocha's Land Responsibility Oral History Project. And if you wouldn't mind stating your name and your title.
Yeah. My name is Bruce Kocha, Senior Lecturer at the University of Washington, Bothell.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about your position as a lecturer, what your topic is?
This is my second stint on this committee. I joined the committee early, I think, in 2000 and served for 2 or 3 years and then moved off of it because of other responsibilities. But I was selected because I was former director of the Human Rights Education and Research Network, and now I'm on the steering committee for the Human Rights, the UW Center for Human Rights. And so I think in that capacity, that's also what I research and teach. So they fit into my professional bailiwick.
Okay, so basically we're covering today the recent negotiations between UW and Nike regarding the closure of the Vision Tech and Hugger factories in Honduras. So essentially we'd like for you to walk us through, in your own words, the process from beginning to end. So maybe you can just start with how the matter initially came to your attention.
I was appointed to the committee in April of 2009, but we didn't really start engaging any major issues until September of that year. The issue had already surfaced with the previous version of the Advisory Committee on Trademarks and Licensing and come to their attention. I'm not exactly sure how, but I do know there was an early letter from SLAPP that had demanded something be done about this. But we started engaging it in September, looking at the issues, checking what we saw as Nike's response, what our code required, and working with WRC and FLA, with a lot of communication by Kathy Hogan and Margaret Levy, with those groups, and also with the actor or labor activists in the South, in Honduras, particularly I think it's the CGT, and we were mostly in a gathering phase. The students were pushing, the students on our committee and visitors were pushing us to act quickly. We wanted to make sure we acted responsibly, so there was a tug back and forth between those two positions. Essentially, in the case at hand, the way I saw it, there were two issues that needed to be addressed. One was how much product was being produced at these factories under Nike supervision of some kind or knowledge. And that was a tricky one because Nike was avoiding, seemed to be delaying telling us or being forthright about exactly how much. There was a lot of controversy over how much was actually being produced. So that in the final analysis, the amount isn't quite as serious. Nevertheless, we wanted our facts straight. And that took some sorting out from different players. The second issue was whether or not Nike had a responsibility to pay that back pay. It claimed it didn't. People on the committee thought it did, reading our code in a particular way, especially the part that demands that anyone licensing a new product obey the laws of the country that they're in, and that is definitely a law in Honduras that there is a mandatory severance pay for workers when factories are closed down. So we had several intense meetings over that particular issue, and we were pushing toward a vote on that issue. I'm trying to 2009. We were pushing through, I think, the winter of training, my dates correct here. Into the spring to try and get clarity on these issues. We were, especially Margaret Levy was in contact with President Emmert. The controversy over Phyllis Wise erupted. Her joining the board of Nike and being the provost, that had now really complicated the issue and raised a lot of flags and a lot of attention. There were articles in the local press, electronic press, as well as print press over this issue, and so we were particularly concerned that we still act responsibly in that regard. I think most of us were worried about that. We didn't want to pile on and get sidetracked by peripheral issues, but it was hard because there's a lot of attention on that one. In the final analysis, we wrote again through WRC, I think it was. We contacted Nike and wanted a definitive statement on how much product was being produced. They couldn't come up with that to our satisfaction, and for me, that was a critical issue. They definitely had a responsibility to let us know where their supply chain really was, etc. However, I must say at the same time, we had brought in a speaker, Richard Locke, to talk about supply chains as a well-known academic scholar on supply chain issues. And his essential point was it's far more complex than you probably realize in terms of contracting and subcontracting. These things are not always clear. Orders aren't always clear. They're working on strange deadlines sometimes. So I gained a little bit more, I think, appreciation for the complexity of the situation. And because of that, remain somewhat reluctant to censure Nike over the payment, over exactly how much they knew about the supply. So I was one of the kind of holdouts in terms of voting to censure Nike, or essentially what we were going to do was write a letter to President Emmert saying, we advise you to censure Nike. At one point, he did that. At one point, he contacted them and demanded a meeting and some information, etc. So he got involved, and so we were waiting back and forth for letters and 30-day waiting periods, etc. Finally, probably leaving out a lot of juicy details. Finally, it came to an initial vote, and I voted to hold Nike accountable for its supply chain, for what it knew about its supply chain, but I abstained on the vote to demand that they pay the back pay. And my reasoning and argument was that I see a potential moral hazard involved in this situation where if private corporations in the developed world take over the function of law in developing countries, then those countries never build the capacity and infrastructure to enforce their own laws. And so the Ministry of Labor is already weak in Honduras, isn't going to get any stronger. Small subcontractors will dissolve and walk away from their responsibility, potentially, and leave larger corporations holding the bag, which in the final analysis may encourage larger corporations to go to countries where there is no severance pay commanded by law, or to pressure Honduran government to eliminate that particular law. So putting economic pressure on these developing country governments to make their labor supply more accessible to multinational corporations, which in the long run I think is really, would be truly disastrous. Of course, really moved by the condition of the Honduran workers, especially in this economy. Their jobs have been drying up in the apparel industry and in Central America, and so it really was a tug of war for me on how to go on. So I didn't vote against it, but I did abstain on that particular vote. And I think actually I'm getting up. I might be getting my meetings a little bit mixed up because this is fast and furious. But there was a final, at some point, a final kind of vote, and I voted definitely to censure. And that was, and the abstention, that must have been it. And then, so the vote to send the letter of censure passed APDL and went to Emmert. Emmert declared that by the end of 2010, if the situation had not been resolved, we would end one of our two contracts with Nike, specifically the licensing contract, but of course not the athletic contract, which is the big one. The licensing contract is a few $200,000, and relative to the $35 million contract, but it would be a really a real dent in their reputation, and it already was, I think, happening. Cornell joined us, though it doesn't have a powerful, it doesn't have a major contract. Minnesota was, and I think their president had censured, had censured, and though again they didn't have a big contract. So we were actually one of the big players at that game. And then it was announced late spring, early summer that Nike had capitulated and would be giving them $1.5 million. Oh, prior to that, we had also asked for various ameliorations of what they were doing. They had promised that they would become active in retraining Honduran workers and finding other jobs for them and setting up programs through the union. We didn't see any headway in that either, so we were worried that we were just being, you know, oversizing smokescreens. We haven't really taken it up. We've gotten more off onto other issues now. We're working at re-looking at our code. One of the questions we will ask is, do we want to put severance pay into our code? And we're comparing our code with others and seeing other places where we need to strengthen it to write better language that's clear. So that's the process we're in. Our job now will be to make sure we monitor the agreement by Nike to give the money. And we'll be in contact with WRC and FLA and with folks there. One of the another sort of spin-off of this case and the other cases is that we realized that, again, that this is a really big, complex process. I knew very little about the bookstore and how it sources its stuff and how much it orders and why and when it has to place the order and, you know, can the bookstore do anything legally when it, those are a whole bunch of questions we don't know. And the same is true, we need better knowledge of what Nike's doing and what the university's doing with other companies. So I suggested a teach-in on these issues on campus. That's now expanded itself to a big conference on April 1st, 2011, in which we'll bring in a whole bunch of these players, but also other players at the university who are engaged in purchasing at some time. Because we want to see if we can get a handle on what is the responsibility of the university in the broader sense, not just picking on a company or picking on one company at a time, but rather saying, okay, what can we build into our ethos from the very get-go?
Great. So I just have, that was like the best summary. But I do have a couple of follow-up questions. One would be, so one of the things you mentioned was the visiting professor who talked about supply chain issues, and that sounded like it was important to you in your decision-making. What were the other primary sources of information that were coming to you, and which of those sources were sort of most vital to your own views on the issue?
Well, the way I approach this is realizing that all of the people in this have some kind of angle, which isn't necessarily bad, but they have things to work with. So I try and do what they call triangulation. Right? I look at what the WRC is saying. I look at what Nike is responding. I look at some of what academics are saying. I listen to my colleagues who know probably a lot more than I do about this. But I put it all together myself by looking at a variety of those sources. I listen to what the students have to say. They often have critical information that comes through their chains, USAS and student skin sweatshops and SLAP. They often get information through other schools that come to them. And we pay attention to what other schools are doing too. We track the news, etc. So I would just say I put together, you know, a lot of that documentation. Kathy Hogan has a lot of documentation, and she's been really terrific in sort of providing these letters. We asked her, Kathy, can you talk to Nike and ask them this question? And she will get us that information and right up front. So that's generally how I operate in this regard. We've also started some academic work studying codes of conduct and how they operate and what they're good for.
You mentioned also that some of the initial attention that came to the matter came from the SLAP, which is sort of the UW USAS group. Do you want to say anything more about the student group and their involvement in the process?
Well, their role is absolutely crucial, and they push us in, I think, very healthy ways. I think sometimes a little too fast, not necessarily in any wrong direction, but maybe a little too fast. I was also, one of the issues I was it's really crucial to me is that act all remain credible. And if we act rashly or look like we're just going after people too quickly, then they'll stop dealing with us. The president will ignore us. Nike will stop answering questions and don't walk away. So I think the students have a vital role in that. They aren't quite as constrained as we are, because we're appointed by the president to advise the president, and we have to give the best advice as possible, and we have to be really careful of that. So, but no, I respect them a lot and what they've done, and having on this campus 40 years ago been with them, demanding change, I certainly appreciate that part of it too, and I'm really happy to be there. So, so I would say primarily the role for us is that they push us to write information and argument and really keep us honest from that point of view. So.
Great. One of the other questions that we've been asking the committee members is if they can talk a little bit about the internal dynamics of the committee and, I guess, consensus building and how you all came to the final decision that you made. So you talked a little little bit about that already.
Right. It's my understanding is that previous, in between my stints on the committee, previous versions of the committee had trouble working together. I think Margaret has done an excellent job. She has a lot of experience doing this, and she's done it before too. I think we've done an absolutely excellent job of keeping the arguments on the table, keeping them civil, working together, being clear at what we want to ask ourselves, and it's one of the best functioning committees I've been on that deals with controversial and difficult issues like this. So I think all of the players, we have a balance of people from different parts of the university, and that's incredibly helpful. Yeah, undergraduates and graduates, faculty, staff, administration, athletic department sits in occasionally. We also have trademarks and licensing, of course. And that broad base keeps us honest because it keeps us informed of how any particular issue is affecting all these different players. And so I think as a group we're doing a really good job of balancing out those issues. So I think the dynamics of this group have been quite good, and I really, my hat goes off to Margaret and her ability to honestly broker the kinds of controversies and disagreements that exist and keep those functioning. So I think that's really good leadership.
So one of the things that you mentioned that happened over the course of these negotiations was that then Provost Phyllis Wise accepted a position on the corporate board of Nike, and there was quite a lot of response to that, and we have interviewed Phyllis also to get her view on that. Do you have anything to add to that conversation?
The timing was just horrid, and I'm not sure she appreciated that timing. Emmert should have. Emmert knew about it, and I think he might have. I'm sure they had conversations, but I think the timing was bad, and I wish she had waited. So I think it really damaged her and the university in the larger, certainly labor community, but also in the progressive community. Stuff on blogs could be relatively scathing, and that of course is a reasoned opinion. So one has to worry about that. And so I think it's okay now. This was also dovetailing with a lot of internal university politics over Emmert's and Wise's salaries, their ties to corporations. That's another reason why we're doing this conference in April 1, to ask this question of closely should we be tied. So it was just a really unfortunate timing. The other thing for me, one of the things is the controversy that Nike got itself into over this football player, Ben Roethlisberger, who has been, I think now, accused or indicted twice for rape and according to the reports, a really brutal guy and a real thug, and Nike refused to pull their contract. Some people thought they should pull their contract with Tiger Woods. Yeah, but you know that's private stuff. But this is really domestic violence and violence against women is such a serious issue in the society, and it gets laughed away as the boys will be boys kind of angle. And I found that when that broke and I saw that stuff, that really just turned my gut against Nike. I was trying to keep my head in control, but I was really, really angry, and I'm sure that swayed me in some way to sort of after a while to say, I'm done. no more comfortable. It's not, you know, I want their head to roll on this one because if they're going to be left out. So I really got pretty upset. I'm still upset by those kinds of things. I mean, it disturbs me when that happens and people laugh it off as all the football players. So those all things, I mean, that's why this case is really pretty fascinating, because it opened up all that stuff all at the same time. It's all coming down, and so you're kind of, you know, swimming in this stuff. So I've worked with Nike. When I was on this committee back around 2000, I debated Nike on the radio instead of somebody up at KOW, and we debated over some of these issues, and it came clear to me then that they were doing some things. They had hired an audit firm to audit their activity overseas, PricewaterhouseCoopers, it's called. And, you know, okay, that's fine, but everything they've done, they've had to be forced to do. I shouldn't be so critical, because, you know, they do have Office of Corporate Responsibility now. Caitlin Morris has been in the past one of the people working for them. I think these people do have ethical concerns in mind at all times. But I think, you know, corporate board and stockholders, right? So they have to be pushed. They're not going to willingly, and I guess that's why we're here. It's unfortunate. I'd rather be doing other things, but try to do it sometime.
You know, obviously the reason we're doing the project is the final settlement was pretty unprecedented. Not necessarily legally, certainly a legal precedent, but it was certainly seemed to set a precedent potentially for Nike and for other apparel companies. So, sort of, what are your thoughts? Do you hope, what kind of precedent do you hope this will be?
Well, to be really honest, I hope it's just an emergency response, and I really don't think this is sustainable in the long run, and I really hope it opens up. I don't know what the next step's going to be, or how Honduras is going to react, or how Nike's going to react in the long run, or Adidas, or Reebok, or any of the other, Russell now we have on board, sort of. But they have to be monitored as well. We really don't know how the big players are going to act in the face of this. Now, to them, I mean, $1.5 million is chump change. Nike's a billions and billions dollar corporation, so it's not a huge amount, and I think they got out of the bad PR, especially with connected to Phyllis and all that stuff. And so I think they kind of got off on this one, and that worries me a bit. On the other hand, one has to, I'm always reminded, you know, you can't hold up things, you know, just because they're not your perfect implementation of principles. Sometimes just getting people some money and helping them out is a good thing to do, and that, you know, the bigger picture is going to have to take longer to work itself out. But I really, one thing that's been really helpful for us here is that on the heels of the Estefel case and the heels of the Russell case and now this case, we've really done some good stuff. And we've really pushed this university to be, to take some leadership roles in, you know, pushing this responsibility and using our code of conduct for something that, other than just, just papering the wall with it, we're actually using it. We got a lot of work to improve it. It's hard work, but that's also really helpful. But as I said, and I've articulated it already, I do worry about the long-term building of capacity and infrastructure in developing countries to handle these cases on their own. We've seen this in a lot of development work where, you know, the developed world, global north goes in and helps out the global south, and the global south doesn't build the kinds of stuff they need to build in order to do it on their own. And that's ultimately the goal. So anyway, mixed bag for me on that, on those two fronts. Glad to see them work with us. I've got the money and potentially a new job, but I worry about the whole
thing. So one of the things you've been asking people is how aware they were of the final settlement before it was publicized. Our current understanding is that most of the final negotiations seem to have taken place between Nike and the union, CGT. So were you aware of it before they announced it? Or
I wasn't, and I didn't see it coming. I mean, trying to recall, I guess I don't know if my memory is distorted by the shock of the actual settlement being published, but I don't remember any hint that they were actually going to capitulate, and it sounded all along like, I mean, they said in early letters, we are not responsible for the severance package and we're not going to pay it. And so they seemed adamant on that point. I thought they might try some other kind of finagling way. I didn't think they would announce a cash settlement and say, here you go.
So I think my last question is, and I think you might have an interesting response to this. One of the things we ask people typically is, since the committee issued a recommendation to censure Nike and to let the contract expire, or at least one of the contracts with Nike expire, what were the alternatives to licensing Nike? Were those alternatives really discussed, or was it sort of just assumed that another brand would be able to take the place of Nike in terms of...
That was my assumption. We had been hearing of, you know, Nike's apparel and Alta Gracia and other people coming forward to get into this market, because a lot of them, there'd actually been, I think Kathy was working with people on doing a study in bookstores to find out would people shop and buy responsible clothing. So there was some of that work done, and it's early stages, and there wasn't definitive research, as I recall, or even necessarily very positive at that point, but it's getting on people's radar. So the assumption was, my assumption was, if Nike dropped their contract, big deal. You know, there's no skin off my back. So the sweatshirts are still going to be made by somebody, and they're just going to make them. And I think that's in fact what's happening now, moving Alta Gracia into the bookstores, and sort of, you know, we have a, we're not going to get in the business of promoting any one product over another, but we certainly want to inform the student body and the schools and all the moms and everybody who buys this stuff that they now have an option. They can buy socially responsible product. We have a responsibility too of being honest that Nike settled and that, you know, that, you know, so I think we have to be honest about that. Again, credibility is an important issue here for me in this regard. So.
Okay, I think those are all the questions I have for you. So can you think of anything else that you might want to add before we start?
No, I mean, it's been an interesting roller coaster. Issues, as I said before, when you step back and look at the complexity of all the things that go into something like this, it's, in and of itself, it's a fascinating story, and I hope our conference on April 1st can bring a little bit of coherence to that, so that we all start to understand better big institutions like that. University actually work and what their ethical responsibilities are. That's my hope and my hope. And I think we're doing a pretty good job starting to. Still have work to do on the athletic department, but.
Great.